Let's talk a little bit about something other than the main topic of the day, which we'll get to in a minute. See, the USDA just announced, under the cover of a lot of distraction, that they're going to give $50 million in climate smart agriculture. That's an actual phrase that they used, climate smart agriculture, which means they're going to give $50 million towards something that isn't justifiable in the free economy, right? Because if it were justifiable, you'd already have companies doing it, right? If there were a reason for it to be created, then you'd already have private companies moving to fulfill that need. But not only that, and also the fact that since we're talking about climate smart agriculture, we're talking about something that's based upon dealing with a lie, the lie of man-made climate change. But on top of all of that, on top of all of it, you've also got the fact that this $50 million will be awarded preferentially in the name of racial equity and justice, to the socially disadvantaged racial and ethnic classes. This is not me making this up. This is actually what the USDA, that's for non-Americans, that's the United States Department of Agriculture, is coming up with. There's $50 million in grants, and they give you a list of the racial and ethnic classes to which you have to belong in order to be eligible for this thing. You can be African American, these are the terms that they use. You can be Native American, Alaskan Natives, Asians, Hispanics, and Pacific Islanders. There's a specific race that seems to be missing from that. Only one race that I can think of that seems to be missing from that, and that is, Caucasian or white people. Whichever term you prefer, you can use Europeans, whatever. You know what I mean? And it's the one that's missing. $50 million for this, frankly, crap, because we're talking about climate smart agriculture, that's the basis. So something that we don't need, and then on top of it, you're specifically saying, okay, we're going to give this money for this scam to the companies that are run by people who specifically aren't white. For some reason, they're still a little bit reticent to say we just want non-white people. Instead, they like the whole, well, here's a list of the different ethnic classes that are eligible. It's like at some point they're just gonna switch, right? At some point they're just gonna be like, okay, we don't need to provide a list of racial and ethnic groups that are okay. We can just come right out and say, if you're white, you're not eligible. And sooner or later, that will happen. I mean, there are people who think that it won't, but it's like if you look over at South Africa and so on, yeah, it'll happen. And you can look at over in England at like BBC hiring and stuff like that, and they'll literally say, we're not looking for white people, we're looking for other people or minorities, which is ironic because, increasingly that's not being so, and it's certainly not that way in the BBC workforce. But in any case, that's what they'll say. Eventually, they're just going to come right out and say it. And I kind of came across that, and I was thinking, this is the United States Department of Agriculture, right? It's a massive bureaucratic agency that is far too big and has been for a very long time. I've literally ranted on this show before, some of you remember the Pickle document, about just how large the USDA is in terms of its bureaucracy, in terms of just how many people work there, in terms of, have you ever seen the building size in Washington, D.C.? I believe I read somewhere that by square footage, it's the biggest building in Washington, D.C. That's the United States Department of Agriculture. So, it's like, I'm all for cutting it. Seriously, like we talk all the time about how the government should be scaled back. Yeah, and it's the biggest agency in employees too. We talk all the time about how government should be scaled back, and very few people are willing to say, okay, let's cut here and there. Let's start actually scaling back some of these agencies. But seriously, that should be gone. Okay, anyway, let's go ahead and move on. I think that really, since it's on your mind, the mind of the collective, we should probably go ahead and talk about what happened today with Biden, because, what else can we talk about as long as that hasn't been said? All right, so I did actually watch the press conference, and usually I don't watch Biden press conferences because they're awful in many different ways, and it's like, why listen to a press conference when you can just read the announcement after the fact? Because really, that's all he's doing anyway. It's not like he came up with any of it. He's just reading what somebody else, wrote, right? So, I tuned into Let's Be Frank's stream earlier today and watched the Biden announcement. And so, for anybody who somehow has become unaware, the Biden administration is mandating the COVID vaccine for every federal employee. And in addition to the mandate for every federal employee, they're also going to exert illegal force, I'm going to go ahead and say, against the private sector too, so that any company that hires more than 100 employees is required to ensure workers are vaccinated against COVID or are tested weekly under a risk of a multi-thousand-dollar fine, and that this is all being done basically because they're using the provision that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration can come in and you know, which is usually used for preventing workplace accidents and that kind of thing, right? For keeping people safe at the job site. That's OSHA. That's what's usually, that's its usual capacity. And instead they're saying, well, we can just go ahead and push that, like basically limitlessly, and say, well, you know, we can just now require that anybody gets any medical procedure that we want them to have. And you're just going to have to deal with it. And in so doing, basically exert force to create a national vaccine mandate to every working person in the country. Because ultimately, that's what we're talking about, right? I mean, sure, right now you might be at 100 plus employees. And I heard some people say, well, you know, we'll just split into a couple of LLCs and we'll have one that's 50 and another that's, you know, 40 or whatever. Okay, but let's be honest here. The slippery slope thing isn't a fallacy, it's what's happening. So, it stands to reason that right now, if they're at, you know, over 100 employees, it's an arbitrary number, and there's no reason whatsoever why they can't come back later and say, okay, so now it's if you've got 10 employees. You know, so realistically speaking, this is essentially Biden acting as king. I mean, yes, there are people behind the scenes who are, you know, writing the rules and writing what's on the teleprompter and all of that. I get it. But in any case, he's still presenting as king, even if he's one that's controlled and even if there are puppet strings, he's still acting as king. And in that capacity has basically rolled out a federal national or national vaccine mandate on every working American. Which ought to be shocking. It really ought to be shocking. And I do think that a lot of people are taken back. I mean, I hate to reference Twitter for a plethora of different reasons. But, you know, I think the top trending topic right now is I will not comply. And that's a good sign, mostly because it's just leftists who still go there at this point. So that's a little bit endearing, I will say. But the truth is that the only way that this doesn't get worse, the only way to stop this from actually being enforced is if people do not comply. Ultimately, that's it. Is if mass numbers of people say, we will not comply. And yeah, I do think there's going to be a bunch of different lawsuits, and I think there should be a bunch of different lawsuits in response to this. Because, frankly, people's rights matter. And that boils down to the most basic right to be able to feed your family, right? I mean, it really does boil all the way down to that, to ultimately, you know, you have the right to be able to engage in free commerce, free trade, you might say, in order to earn your own living, in order that you might be able to feed your own family. And it's not just a good, it's sort of a moral duty, a moral imperative. It's something that you have to do regardless of what country in the world you happen to have been born. It's a basic part of life. And it's on that basis that I'm saying this is an infringement upon a person's most basic human rights. It doesn't really matter what's codified and written down for the sake of this argument. I think it's pretty clear to anyone that this would be in violation of the rights that are given to you, frankly, by God. And yes, I do think that there is, at a certain point, a line that should not be crossed, that cannot be crossed by a government. Speaking of which, before I go any further on that, apparently, before Biden did this speech thing, he went ahead and mobilized the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and also the Secret Service, so that they could monitor online chat to make sure that they could do something about any rebellion talk that was going on. Seriously, I'm not making this up. We have actually announcements now, right, that that he was actually using these agencies because he was afraid that upon announcing the fact that he was going to act like a tyrannical dictator slash king, that people might say, hey, we don't want a king in the United States of America. In fact, you know, we separated from, you know, England because we didn't want a king. So let's not do that. You know, you would expect something along those lines, right? But instead, you've got these different federal agencies who are working to make sure that you don't have somebody who says, you know, 1776. Which, doesn't something seem a little bit tyrannical about that in and of itself? The fact, you know, that they already knew ahead of time, like, okay, we announced this thing, this infringement on people's basic rights and ability to live, and people are going to get a little riled up, and people are going to start saying that we're tyrannical and dictatorial and maybe even talk about revolution. You'd think that maybe that would clue them into the fact that, in the very least, at a very limited level, that maybe they weren't representing the people, right? Because that's what they're supposed to be doing as elected representatives, right? Remember, these are the people who, and this is the thing, these people call Trump a fascist. And you know, I've had my qualms with Trump and which bills, which omnibuses especially he signed and stuff. And I've talked about them. But he was nowhere near the fascist that they claimed him to be. In many regards, I always thought, you know, if he was a little bit more fascistic, you know, and shut these people up, okay. I have kid. But seriously, these are the people who called Trump a fascist, and here they are saying you don't have the right to feed your family unless you take this shot, this may or may not be vaccine. If you take this injection that, you know, may or may not be safe because we've created an environment where people no longer can even speak out like they can in Japan when there was the contamination that took place in the Moderna vaccines, as we talked about before, in a parallel environment here, I don't think people would be as willing to speak out and risk everything, because you would have to risk everything in order to speak against or perceivably against any vaccine, right? Vajida says you cannot buy or sell without the mark of the beast, right? Precisely, it's really difficult to look at this and not see the kind of biblical parallels there. You know, the kind of, I guess you could say, end timesness. It is really difficult to do that. And it does seem like people are being forced into a position where they can't really be lukewarm. They have to make a choice. And it's being placed in a very, they're being placed in a very difficult situation. I don't want to be the person who's like, you know, sitting here and saying, well, if you take the vaccine, you know, you're X, Y, and Z. The trouble is, you know, you might be in trouble if you do. But at the same time, I recognize the incredible hardship. And that's why I said this whole thing is evil. Because the amount of force that is placed on a person when he's told, you know, it's not just you that's in potential peril, right, if you refuse this vaccine, but it's anybody who relies on you. And I don't want to seem like I don't have any compassion for the people who are in that situation, because I do realize there are a lot of people out there who are facing that situation today, and it's a terrible situation that they're in, and they shouldn't be in it. It is absolutely wrong, and it is immoral that they would be placed in a position where they would have to make that choice. And I will say, Biden several times during his speech, if we're going to call it his speech, let's just, you know, just for the sake of ease in this conversation, I'll call it his speech, you know, even though it's not, all right. He said, I'm going to quote one of these. He said it in various different ways, different variations of this, but he said, quote, "This is not about freedom. This is not about personal choice," unquote. And that is an exact quote of what he said. Okay. Not about freedom. It's not about personal choice. In other words, okay, I'm going to translate. You don't have any freedom. You don't have any personal choice. Because that's what he means. Because it absolutely is about freedom, and it is about your personal choice. It cannot be divorced from those things, ultimately, right? But what he's actually saying is that you don't have any freedom. And that's where we are at a point where you have the king who goes on TV, says, you will take the shot or you will not have employment. You will not have a job and you'll be, you know, kicked out of your home and etc. And you don't have any freedoms. And he doesn't quiver in saying those words. And it seems like if you could go back 10 years or so, that you would not have a politician who would say that. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that 10 years ago you wouldn't have had a politician who infringed upon your rights. I get it. We've had the Patriot Act for a while now. But they would at least give lip service, right? And I think that the lip service is, well, a slight improvement, okay? It's not huge, but it means that in a situation where the politician is giving lip service, it means that you have a situation where the government at least partially fears the people. At a point where the politician is no longer giving lip service, that situation has been reversed, and that is exactly where we are. We're in a situation where the people are in fear of the government. And I don't think that should be something that should be understated. Okay, let me go ahead and see what you guys think. Cal DeFranco says, it's not what Democrats say, it's what Republicans aren't saying. Well, I do want to say, I would say yes. However, I have been a little bit surprised at the degree to which even the kind of conservative ink types have been opposed to this. And maybe they're only opposed because they're playing the game, you know, Biden's a Democrat, and if it had been a Republican, then, you know, it would have been fine. That's entirely possible, right? However, I am pleased to see, in the very least, you know, lip service maybe, you have the Republicans who are saying, hey, this is over the line, you don't have the authority to do this. James says, if you care about the nation, you uphold the Constitution. Well, you would think, which brings me to the next point as to essentially the relevancy of that, which is that Biden in that speech threatened to take on the states, right? So, and he did that in multiple ways. In one part, he said, if these governors won't help us beat the pandemic, I will use my power as president to get them out of the way. Now, of course, naturally, my thoughts go toward the 10th Amendment, toward the rights of the states to be independent and to have some degree of control over their own self-management, right? That's where my mind goes, and I think most people's did. He also talked about reimbursing the pay of the teachers who lose their job because they're essentially fighting in a pro-vaccine, pro-mask way. Like, it was basically an attack against Florida, who is the main state, or which is the main state that's been kind of resisting the Biden encroachment. The political doggo, welcome, says, don't forget Joe Biden said their patience is wearing thin. In other words, they're getting tired of people having to deal with our freedom, it's getting in the way. Yes, and that was in relevance to the unvaccinated, for anybody who didn't watch, and good for you if you didn't watch. If you just tune out for these press conferences, I don't blame you. Like I said, I usually do too. But yeah, he said that it was in relevance to the unvaccinated, and he said our patience is wearing thin. You know, like he was some kind of parent or dictator it's really impossible to hear those words without hearing it as a threat. Right? Because that's what it means. You know, if you've ever had a parent say that to you, it means if you don't comply, things are going to get a lot worse, right? I mean, this isn't me, you know, being a hyperbolic at this point. That's pretty clear that that's the case. It's pretty clear that what he's saying is that if you don't comply, we will use the force of the government. Heck, he is using the force of the governments already. And yeah, I do expect there to be lawsuits from this, and I certainly hope that they can get basically an immediate injunction to put a halt to it. But regardless, I think that there has to be a time that comes where people say, en masse, you know, we won't comply. And I have heard of some workforces already that are sort of ganging together, you know, the employees are saying basically, we're all going to say, no, we're not going to do this to their employer. And I do think that it is a strategy that you may end up using. and have to use, as opposed to kind of mounting a singular battle against your employer individually. You also still have those websites that I think I mentioned last time, but you're welcome to check out again. That's at novaxmandate.org. Vax is V-A-X. And you can find basically jobs by companies that aren't going to force their employees to get a medical treatment that they don't find, you know, that they don't want, frankly. Because it really comes down to that. Ultimately, you don't get to force somebody to take a medical treatment that they don't want, because every medical treatment and every vaccine comes with risks. It does, and it's not even just me saying that. You know, the FDA maintains its own little list of vaccine adverse event reactions, as it's called, and records them, and has, you know, throughout the entire history of vaccines, or at least actually since the since we started compensating people for damage through a private court system that doesn't go through the regular courts. Yeah, it gets really weird when you talk about vaccine compensation. But in any case, there is nobody disputing the fact that some people are harmed by every vaccine. It's in the nature of it. So anyway, if you are looking for some alternative job, there is novaxmandate.org. There is also novax.jobs. That's novax.jobs. In both of those cases, vax is spelled V-A-X. And so I want to go ahead and put that out there, because I know some people are within pretty large companies and feel like they're not going to have a choice pretty quickly and are afraid that they won't have a sort of mobilizing potential. I get it. I really do sympathize with the situation that you might find yourself in. It is cruel and it is evil. It really is. Richard Toth says, they've had a grand design to enslave us all, and it's being executed much more so in our time now. I can't disagree with that. It seems like they're moving ahead pretty quickly, frankly. Biden today said that it was the job of the president to protect every American. And I was like, well, not really. I mean, you could say it's the job of the president to protect American freedoms, you know, that he can pursue whatever he wants, some of which have risks, right? Because if it were, in fact, the job of the president to simply protect, you know, to kind of act as nanny state, I mean, then wouldn't he start shutting down professions that were dangerous? Wouldn't he start shutting down, in the very least, activities? You know, paragliding would be banned, you know, by the president's decree. Why not? It's dangerous, right? Well, because this is America and we have freedoms, including the freedoms to make what some people might call bad decisions, or simply decisions that we want, decisions that we assess ourselves, right? I mean, and how far does that go? If you accept the whole phrase, right, that it's the job of the president to protect every American, and then you accept that, in the very least, he means this in terms of deciding the medical choices of individual Americans, right, because clearly that's the case, I'm not extrapolating here at all, then what? Then how far does that logically extend? Because I don't really see any sort of end. In fact, what I see is the sort of setup for a nationalized healthcare system in which they start denying care to individuals that don't comply, as you've seen in other countries where they're like, well, you know, we've got a nationalized healthcare system in this country, you know, like Greece or something, but you smoke, so why would we help with your, you know, say lung cancer or whatever? Doesn't really matter if the two are related. But in any case, decisions not like that start getting made in countries that have nationalized, or socialized, if you prefer, healthcare systems. And we know that Biden and Kamala both want socialized healthcare systems, and they're already breaching the, I don't know if you can call it a gap, but they're already kind of plowing ahead in destroying the sense that an individual ought to have the right to make his own medical decisions, whatever they happen to be, that it's his right to decide, you know, on a case-by-case basis, whether something is advantageous to him personally, makes sense to him personally, or frankly, if he wants it, right? I mean, just if he wants it, because, you know, dang it, you know, he's an American, he's free, he's a human being. and he ought to have the right to make whatever healthcare decisions he wants and not have to justify it to anybody, including the bureaucracy and power of the federal government and all of the different corporations that they're paying in some totally not backhanded way, you know, when they're giving massive amounts of money to these vaccine companies using your tax dollars and then telling you that after you've already paid for it, you're then required to actually, you know, take it into your arm. But that's exactly where we are. Oh, and by the way, the National Institutes of Health just ordered a, $1.6 million study on how the COVID-19 vaccine impacts menstrual cycles. Or in other words, women's reproductive health. That's where we are here. I've actually got something on this. Yeah. Now, just gonna ask, okay, they're doing this now. Does anybody think that's a little bit belated? That we're studying it now after the fact? Not even just after we've just got a mandate that's gonna affect, you know, maybe 100 million Americans. But even the fact that it's been this whole time they've been saying, it's safe, we know it's safe, it's so safe, how can you question it, you bigot conspiracy theorists, but it's like, you're still doing the studies on women's reproductive health, which if you read the article, and you're welcome to, there's the title and there's the publication, if you read the article, they're like, well, we know that something's wrong, that it is affecting women in ways that we didn't think it would. So it's like, okay, so I'm sorry, I don't find that particularly endearing that you say that it's affecting women in ways we didn't think it would, and yet at the same time it's being mandated and nobody can question it. I don't think it's just me who's sitting here going, okay, maybe something isn't perfect about that picture. I don't find it particularly comforting. The idea that the reproductive health of women is just kind of an afterthought that comes sometime after mandates. I mean, because that's what we're talking about. Okay, anyway. Yeah, I'm just kind of looking through your comments, and it looks like, I mean, you're in agreement, but I don't really see how there could be much of a disagreement at this point. It's like, we're still studying the darn thing. Some of these comments I can't read off just simply because there are lots of things that I can't say when it comes to the vaccine. I can, however, talk about the moral issues with it, and I think they are plenty. Like, I mean, not the moral issues with taking a vaccine per se, but the moral issues with a person being forced to take any drug against his will, all of which have, you know, potential side effects that will affect some people. We don't know why. And I say we don't know why because literally we don't. Like, you can have one person who submits to a lab, let's say, and gets every scan that we currently have that's known to medical science. And then you can have a whole new drug, whatever it happens to be, or a vaccine, which is also a drug. And we have no way of knowing, after that person has been completely tested in every test under the sun, we have no way of knowing if the person will have a side effect to that drug and which side effect he will have. And like it or not, and nobody does, but that is the state of medical science right now. And that makes everybody uncomfortable because nobody wants to know how little we actually know. You know, how frankly bad and lacking our science really is. Nobody wants to hear that because it gives us some degree of sense of control and order, which all humans need and like. You know, the idea that medical science is a science that is close to being perfected, as most people think. But it's like, if you just think about something as basic as that, as can we predict a side effect? It's like, well no, because they're side effects, and that means that they're kind of random from one person to another, otherwise they're just the effect. Right? It's kind of like that. That's medical science. Sorry. To kind of break it to you, but that's the way that it is. And now we're studying. So now we'll find out what the potentials will be, what the list is of what could happen. It's insane. And kind of on a similar topic, it was in Australia today. you had a press conference of their own. They were kind of like trying to rival Biden, thinking, you know, just how kind of far can we push this thing, you know? Because Biden went pretty far. No, actually, this one was first, in truth. But it was a Dr. Kerry Chant, who was the chief health officer of New South Wales, which is one of their states. I'm not sure if they're called provinces. But in any case, I'm pretty sure it's an Australian state. And in which, in any case, this doctor, this official of the government, said, and I quote, "We will be looking at what contact tracing looks like in the New World Order," unquote. And if you spent much time online, you can go ahead and look up that video. It's not difficult to find yet. Now, what was interesting is not the fact that this doctor, this woman, used the words New World Order without any sort of irony, without slowing down, without thinking, hey, this is kind of an indicator that we're seeking to change the world order in a way that has been predicted by people who we have described as conspiracy theorists for at least the past 20 years, but likely more. Nope, didn't slow down for any of that. And then what happened is that every big tech site in existence decided to put a little banner underneath where this video had been, you know, released, saying something about how the New World Order is a conspiracy theory. And this happened on Twitter. They had something about how it was unfounded. You know, it was an unfounded accusation that this was, you know, bringing in a New World Order. And then you had at YouTube, you had the very similar banner that showed up in searches when you were searching for this particular thing, and it showed up on some videos. You know, so make sure that people who hear a government official say that phrase then see the little warning that, hey, just, it's not happening. Nothing is happening. I mean, like, all of them, all the big tech companies, all immediately ran into action, because nothing says we're not bringing about a new world order quite like a banner that appears to tell you that, you know, you can't really hear what it is that you think that you're hearing. Because, I mean, seriously, you had fact checkers today, and I say fact checkers in the ironic sense that it's come to be known, right? The Snopes type people. They were saying that New World Order is commonly used to describe times of change and cultural shift. That's the spin that they put on it. Yeah, it's just, we're just going through a time of change and cultural shift, don't you know? It's difficult to take these people seriously, but really, that's where we were. Or where we are, rather. It was also the Australian Health Minister, Brad Hazard, who said a little further back, "We've got to accept that this is the New World Order." So you got basically two different Australian officials at different levels of power, both pretty high up, talking about bringing in a new world order at the time when in Australia people are being arrested for leaving their homes, right? People are being arrested for not wearing a mask. People are being arrested for protesting. People are being arrested for reporting, you know, including going to a protest to actually, you know, report like a journalist. People are being arrested for that. Australia has descended into a tyranny. And I don't think, I mean, this isn't me, you know, talking from a place of great betterment, you know, not after today with Biden's little announcement about the mandated vaccines for basically everyone. Okay, just so you realize, this isn't me being particularly judgy on Australia right now, because I realize that the entire world is descending into something that a conspiracy theorist might refer to as a new world order, but we won't, because, you know, we're trying to be objective here. But in any case, it's like, I mean, my gosh, you've got these different massive public officials who are talking about this plainly, you know, not even pausing, not slowing down, not thinking, hey, maybe I should just put this a little bit differently so as to prevent public outrage or public concern. None of that. They just kind of go soaring ahead. And it's a lot like what I was talking about earlier with the Biden thing and how politicians in America used to give lip service and now they don't, and how that's a really bad indication of the way that we're going, because it indicates that they don't fear the people as much as they ought to. It's the same thing. It really is. It's just that, you know, in Australia, they're just using the term New World Order. But the indication is the same. It's the government saying, we don't care what you think. we are going to change the world in which the regular people, the previously citizens, will become subjects or slaves, if you prefer, and will follow the order of the dictates of the world government that's coming. That's what you've got them saying. Richard Toth says, George H.W. Bush always referred to the New World Order. That's true. And they had Ross Perot helped Clinton replace him. It shocked people at the time. Best now they call it the Great Reset. Well, yeah, that is true. All that's true. They do use the term the Great Reset now because it sounds so much more endearing, because they are trying for now, sort of. I mean, less so today than ever. But in any case, there was certainly a point in time where they were trying to prevent public panic, and now they've reached a point where they don't really care about the public panicking, and now they're like, we're just going to change things, and you're going to submit and comply, because we've kept pushing and waiting for a pushback, and we're waiting for massive protests and waiting for some degree of insurrection on a small scale, so we know when to stop. But in fact, the people don't fight back, and therefore we're just going to keep on pushing without limit. That is actually what's really the case. It's the government has spent the last, what is it, like year and 8 months as of the moment ish taking away people's freedoms, starting out with, you know, 14 days to flatten the curve. That's how it started, and you know the progression. I don't need to spell it out to you, but here we are at, in the US, vaccine mandates, in Australia, vaccine passports, including being tracked by your phone and being required to, in the very near future, check in on where you are on your phone and, you know, take a picture of yourself within 15 minutes if the government asks you to on your phone, as they track you via location. All of that's the case. And they've also got, you know, checkpoints at different points of travel to make sure that you're traveling for an approved purpose, and arresting people who do not travel for an approved purpose, but instead, you know, want to go play tennis or something like that, or do something that improves their health in an actual real way. But that's too much outdoor activity for the government, or should we just go ahead and, you know, get rid of these barriers and this veneer, and instead say that's just too much freedom and the government won't allow it, and instead they're just going to keep on pushing and pushing until people either fight back or give up. But the thing is, what's really happened? Are people really fighting back? Because if they're not, if people don't fight back, then there is no limit. There is no limit at which a tyrant sits there and says, you know what? I have enough power. It doesn't work like that. I'm sorry, it doesn't. There are a lot of people who seem to think that either it does, or they just really wish that it would, so much so, right, that they're just clinging to it. That, you know what, it's going to end here. I'm going to get this shot, and then everything will be fine. I'll be able to just live my life. And that's all I ever wanted to do, is just live my life. And I can relate to the sentiment, I can, but there are some people that you can't satiate. And there are some people that by trying to satiate, you instead embolden. And that is the case with tyrannical dictators the world over, and moreover, throughout history. It's not that we don't have precedent for this kind of thing. That's how dictators work. They just keep pushing and pushing. And yes, it's kind of the boiling frog theory. But it's not really a theory at this point, is it? You know, they just keep turning up the heat slowly and slowly, and the frog never notices. That's kind of what we have. Except for, it didn't seem like it was that slow for me and a lot of you guys who've been here in this chat and had live streams, heck, at the beginning of the COVID saga, as we're now calling it. But, you know, it was 14 days to flatten the curve. Then it was, you know, you're just going to have to wear this mask for a few months. And they had the lockdowns and the churches were being shut down. And there were so few people who were willing to not just speak up, but fight back in the sense of refusal to comply. Right. And now here we are. And it's just getting worse. And I'm sitting here just kind of waiting. But the thing is, it's not just me sitting here waiting. If it were, that would be one thing. But instead, what we actually have is the government that's sitting there waiting. And it has been, and it's been making judgment calls based upon how much people fight back. No, hold on. (Clears throat) Yeah, and it certainly seems like, and I almost don't blame them. Okay, it's not entirely accurate, but if you were the government and you were, you know, the tyrannical dictator, okay, and all you wanted was unlimited power, and you have to look at it in that sense, what you want is control, absolute control over, let's just say, the people of the United States. And you look at the decisions that have been made, and you look at how much fight people have given. Would you, at this point in time, decide that, you know what, this is the point at which we can't keep pushing? Would you, based upon looking back at the last, you know, year and a half, let's say, would you presume that if you pushed a little further now, that people will rise up? And, you know, everything would fall apart. Just seriously, if you imagine that you're the ultimate tyrant, all you want is power and control, you have to go slow because otherwise people fight. So would you, looking back, presume that you had reached the limit of your power, that you had reached the limit of your exertion? And if so, on what basis? Because yes, I've seen individuals who have fought back and refused to comply, and touche to them, you know, seriously. I mean, it takes a lot to stand around when 90% of people or more are complying, and for you to say, I will not comply. I don't care what the rest of the world does. I don't care what the rest of the people in this supermarket do, or what the rest of the people in my job do. I will not comply. That takes an incredible amount of courage to do so, seriously. But if you're the government and you're looking back, I don't see enough indications of mass upset that I, if I were the tyrant, would not feel comfortable advancing. I'll put it like that. Let's take a look at the chat. Take a Walk says, nobody's pushing for freedoms. It's just a bunch of politicians fake arguing about how they're going to screw you over. I can relate to that sentiment, actually. Yes. I can look at the Democrats and the Republicans throughout this process have had a complete lack of regard for the citizens that they supposedly care so much about. Even as they virtue signal about how they're going to save those lives, they do so while making those lives miserable, while stomping on the God-given rights. And I say that, and that's the very phrase that they use come election time, by the way, is God-given rights, and then they stomp on them during any other time as it's advantageous to what, you know, they want to accomplish. Right, that's actually where we are. Okay. Harati says, I've ditched the mainstream social media sites. Good for you. Tune out as much as possible. Seriously, just tune out as much as possible. It's the best advice I can give to anybody. It'll make you miserable, and it'll just fill you with information that isn't true. That just literally isn't true. And perhaps more importantly, they don't cover the stuff that is true, and so it gives you a false impression of the world. Even if you know that they're lying to you, you don't know what they're admitting. You don't know what stories that, you know, never get covered in the least. Especially things like anti-white crime, stuff like that. They act like that never happens. And in so doing, they paint a picture of the world that isn't accurate in the least. Okay. In fact, the Los Angeles Times, the LA Times, ran an op-ed today, and it was called, Why did so few Latinos identify themselves as white in the 2020 census? Okay, yes, we're moving away from the vaccine for a bit. And it was really fascinating to me because what the basic thesis is this. It's like the share of Latinos who identified their race as white in the 2020 census fell from 53% in 2010 to 20% in 2020. Okay, and that's 53% of them said that they were, you know, white Hispanic in 2010, and then by 2020, it had dropped to 20%. And for me, the answer's obvious. Now, the belief of the person who wrote this article was it's white people's fault, which is really ironic, because they actually came up with a reason through which this was white people's fault. They said that such a xenophobic, or xenophobic if you like, political climate has made many Latinos aware that whiteness may not easily be within their reach. So they just can't act white enough, according to the LA Times. I think the truth is a lot different than that. The truth is that we're living in a world now where being white is considered to be a slur or considered to be a bad thing. In fact, the word whiteness now exists in public lexicon, right? That's where we actually are. We're in a situation where, as I mentioned at the beginning of this show, the USDA came up with their little grant, $50 million, and then decided to give it to only people who are not white. We live in a world where if you get into a university, it's easier if you're not white, and also not Asian, to be fair here. But there aren't advantages in modern society to being white. There aren't. Like, if you go to college, you'll get taught that there are all these different privileges and advantages to being white. And it's like, if that's the case, then why aren't all the Latinos saying, I'm white? Well, they're not, because there aren't any advantages to being white in American society. And further, people are told that they shouldn't associate themselves with it. Remember, whiteness is a slur. And if you extrapolate out what whiteness is, according to, you know, the people who use the term, they don't just mean a person being white. They mean a person who is, in some way, the embodiment of white culture. And there it becomes a real problem, because it's like, well, if you consider white culture itself to be a negative, then what culture is it that we should follow? Like, because white culture is easily replaceable with the term Western culture. And frankly, I don't know of a better culture. I don't. And I don't have any shame in saying that, because it's true. And if you consider whiteness and white culture or Western culture, whatever, to be a negative, and that's increasingly the case, as you see with the way that the Latinos are self-identifying, then where does that leave us? Like, do you want to mirror the culture of the Aztecs or something? You see where I'm going with this? You have to aim for something. You have to aim for a culture. Otherwise, we don't really have a whole lot. We certainly don't have a uniting force, right? And it's like, white colonization, yes, brought civilization around the world to areas that were, frankly, just savage. And none of this should be particularly controversial. I get that it is, but only because we live in a society that says the opposite. But says the opposite in contradiction to what's true and provable, right? And so at this point, yes, it makes more sense for an individual to identify as anything but white. And that proves these people at the colleges and teaching the critical race theory and so on, it proves them wrong. In their most foundational point, which is that we live in a society now that gives some kind of massive preference and privilege to white people, and that white people are actively acting as oppressors against non-white people. That couldn't be further from the truth. The exact opposite is increasingly becoming the case. And that's, it's really clear. Christopher Esquivel says, I remember that the phrase, it's okay to be white, caused a lot of hysteria. It did, and I think that originated on 4chan, if I remember correctly, their idea to go ahead and just print off posters that said it's okay to be white and then plaster them around at colleges and bus stops and so on. And the amount of fervor that it generated was shocking, or at least it ought to be. You know, it ought to be shocking that a phrase that should have been not problematic in the least instead actually got a lot of people riled up, because ultimately the point proven by the 4chan guys was that in modern culture, and especially in colleges, but increasingly in the culture itself, it's not okay to be white. People are instead encouraged to be ashamed of it, and that is actually happening. You know, Latinos who previously identified as being white, you can argue whether they are or aren't, but whatever, they previously thought that they were and previously felt that it was a good thing and part of their identity, instead no longer consider it to be a part of their identity, and consider it to be a bad thing, else they would you know, identify in that regard. Let me go ahead and come down here. And I do want to, as an example, this actually kind of segues kind of well, as an example of how kind of what modern culture is really like, I do want to show you something that happened to the NHS. And for those who don't know, the NHS is the British healthcare provider, right? It's a socialized healthcare network. So it's called the National Health Service. That's what NHS stands for. And pretty much any healthcare provided in the UK is done by the NHS. Well, the NHS published this article, which I'm going to go ahead and show you. This is actually, as you can see, on their website. Dear white people in the UK. It's written by somebody who isn't white that tells you, or that tells us, that basically we should be ashamed of being white. Again, this is at the healthcare site. They're talking about how you should read the book on white fragility, why it's so hard for white people to talk about racism, and so on. And by the way, if you want to look this up, it goes on for pages and pages, seemingly without limit. It just goes on and on. But that's a healthcare provider. Like, it kind of doesn't get more, I don't know what the word would be, non-political, at least in theory, than that. Because if I was providing healthcare, I wouldn't think there would be some kind of racial dynamic for care there. But there is. And this kind of goes in what I was talking about earlier, with the way that our culture is changing. You might say getting taken over, sort of, in a very anti-white way. Because what does it say to white people about what sort of care they're expected to get when they're being told throughout this entire document that they should read all of these different pieces and watch these different pieces about how they have privilege and about how their ancestors are responsible for everything that is bad and how other races should be, in at least a few senses actually, given preference because of supposed previous persecution. That NHS piece is a manifest result. I mean, you can't look at that and deny that something is changing, something is happening, both because that was published and is still up, but also the fact that, you know, the fact that everyone thought that it was okay. Like, if I published a piece, let's just say that I worked for the National Health Service, and I wrote a piece called Dear Black People, or Dear Black People in the UK, let's keep it, you know, exactly correct and paralleled. And then I wrote, and remember, this is as a white person, because that would be an appropriate parallel. And then I wrote about all the things that I thought were wrong with black people, black culture, and black history, and how black people ought to be ashamed, and how white people are in many ways better. That would be the perfect parallel. Now, can you even see that happening? How long do you think it would be up? Do you think I'd be fired? Do you think there would be articles written about me and my background and what a racist I am? All of that would happen. None of us have any doubts about it. And yet, there's something that's not even that surprising when you see that NHS piece, but it would be very surprising if you saw a paralleled piece about, you know, Dear Black People or whatever, right? I mean, it would kind of raise an eyebrow, like, where am I? You know, you know, where did I end up on the internet? Harati says probably would be arrested. Well, yeah, that's certainly the case if in England, that's definitely the case. It would be an actual crime for me to write such a piece. And don't get me wrong, I'm not even saying that it should be a crime to write such a piece. I simply don't think that you should write a piece in the context of being a healthcare provider, especially the only healthcare provider, because you're talking about a socialized system, so it is everything, right? If you're getting care, you're getting care through the National Health Service. That shouldn't happen. But seriously, like, nobody thought this was shocking. Nobody thought this was fire worthy. Nobody spoke up. And at the same time, coming back here to the United States, I keep hearing these leftists online say, well, critical race theory either isn't a big deal or isn't being taught in schools anymore. It's just a myth. Critical race theory is done. It's like, no, critical race theory is being taught in schools. And in fact, there was a recent announcement by like four different mayors. There was Ted Wheeler, Lori Lightfoot, Lauren McLean, and Greg Fisher. All these different people got together and authored a document about how they were going to push critical race theory in their schools, and they were going to do so in order to drive the implementation of critical race theory across America. And for anyone who doesn't know what critical race theory is, you're welcome to look it up. But basically, we're talking about the same sort of thing. White people are bad. White people are oppressive. White people are responsible for everything bad that has ever happened. And even in the modern age, white people are leading the country in a way as to undermine every other racial and ethnic group. And so that was the mayors of Chicago, Illinois, Portland, Oregon, Louisville, Kentucky, and Boise, Idaho, I believe. Yeah. All just ganging up to provide instruction to the other leftist cities throughout the United States. Point here is, if you do have kids who are in the public school, pay attention to what they're actually learning in the public school. Don't just assume that because some leftists online say that critical race theory is gone, that it's actually gone. And I know, this isn't me saying, by the way, that sending your kids to public school is in any way the best solution. I don't think anybody even thinks that anymore, especially on the right. I think that it's become pretty clear that that's not the case. That pretty much everything is better, you know. Private schools are better, religious schools are better, homeschooling is best. I think that's pretty clear. If you have a kid who's in the public school, I'm just going to go ahead and assume that the kid is in the public school because you don't have a better option for one reason, you know, or another. Life is hard, I know. But at least pay attention, at least try and figure out, you know, what's actually going on there. And if you can organize any sort of revolt to change something like critical race theory, we have started to see it around the country in the United States, at least in the last year, year and a half. Organizations of parents speaking up and putting pressure on these school boards, because honestly, school boards are often kind of cowardly and they do what results in least pressure. That's something that people on the right don't seem to realize, is that these people in public positions, especially small town ones like that, they're doing what they're doing out of a sort of calculated cowardice, is what I'd call it. Because it's like, you've got the school board member, right, who's like, well, we're getting this pressure from, you know, random kind of libtarded group. You know, you've got these women who, I don't know how they had children, but they've got their blue hair and all of this stuff. And they're saying, well, we should teach this. And so we're like, okay, we'll do that in order to prevent anything happening, right? We'll do this in order to comply with the wishes of some leftist group. And they don't expect any sort of pushback from traditionalists or conservatives, if you like, but I'm kind of going with the term traditionalist at this point. They don't expect anything from the right, and that needs to change. We need to kind of reach a sort of cultural change such that even in small towns like that, they think that if they're going to implement something like critical race theory or like a mandate on a person's health decisions, that they're going to expect a massive pushback so that a person in that position can't make this decision from a position of calculated cowardice, right? From what's the best solution that I can do for me personally as this bureaucrat, so that I don't have to deal with any pressure, so that I don't basically have to do my job. That's what we need to stop. We need to stop the belief that doing the wrong thing is the easiest thing. We can make it so that it's not. Especially in, like I said, in small towns, groups of families that actually, you know, come together and work together to put pressure on. I think you'd be surprised just how little pressure it often takes on these bureaucrats who never expected any pressure whatsoever to kind of give. Okay, anyway, let me get a drink and then we'll continue. Okay. This is a topic that I just kind of found shocking and disturbing. So, it was a January 6th protester, all right? So, got arrested following the January 6th event. His name is Doug Jensen. And he was eventually released after being held for a few months. And he was released under provisions that would basically necessitate and guarantee his return to jail. It was set up to fail, you might say. So he was released on these strict conditions by a U.S. District Court judge, Timothy Kelly, in which he wasn't allowed to use the internet or his cell phone at all. So Doug Jensen was released and told he couldn't use the internet or his cell phone, and if he did, he would be sent back to jail. Now, I mean, in the modern age, who can function like that? Like, do you know how to get a job without the internet? I mean, finding housing? I mean, basically, everything is on the internet. And yes, you need your cell phone in the very least to communicate with people. You're setting him up to fail. That's exactly what's happening. And then they sent over some what they're calling pretrial services officers, so it's kind of like probation, but he hasn't been sentenced yet, so it's not technically probation, but it's similar. They sent these officers over and found him watching an online discussion featuring the MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell. And because of that, they sent him back to jail. Alright? So, I mean, they created this situation where basically he was set up to fail, and they came over and they saw that he watched a video online in his garage, and therefore he's required to be incarcerated in horrific conditions over in DC. And let's be honest, they are horrific conditions. And one thing that I thought was interesting about the story is that it doesn't stop there. The judge said that he released Jensen originally after he was told that Jensen had an epiphany and no longer believed in the QAnon ideology. And then, after hearing that he watched the MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell, video, then he's like, and this is an actual quote from a real judge in the United States, he says, quote, "It's now clear that he has not experienced a transformation and that he continues to seek out those conspiracy theories," unquote. So we're talking about a person being locked away for his opinions, his political opinions, because the issue wasn't even just that he was, you know, using an electronic device in violation of an edict that made it very difficult for him to live his life. That wasn't even the main issue by this judge. The issue was that he was listening to something of the wrong political persuasion. You know, we used to talk about on this show that political persecution is coming. Well, political persecution is here. It's like, had he been watching a Young Turks video, would we have had a different response? Probably, because then there wouldn't be any connection with the wrong conspiracy theory. And by the way, I've never followed the QAnon stuff. I haven't. You can go back and look. It's not been something I've followed. I just frankly don't care right now. The important thing is that he's an American who has a right to have his own opinions. At least I thought he did. At least he's supposed to have that right to have his own opinions, to come to his own conclusions, to be his own man, to be able to kind of articulate and have his own thoughts. Even it was his attorney, actually, a guy named Christopher Davis, who called it Orwellian, that the government would jail a man for sitting in his garage and listening to an online program. And it's like, yeah, absolutely it is. Like, what else could it be considered at that point? Yeah, Carl DeFranco says, maybe if he read Pride and Prejudice, this never would have happened. That's in reference to last week when we talked about a judge mandating that someone read Pride and Prejudice in order to, you know, become a more enlightened person. This is the way that we keep sliding in the direction of these judges who keep, I guess, mandating a sort of political opinion. And I actually did a video about this topic with the January 6th protesters specifically, about how some of their lawyers, and I don't remember all the names off the top of my head, you'd actually have to go look at the video, but some of the lawyers for these defendants, and these are publicly appointed lawyers, were mandating that their clients read these different, like, super leftist books and give book reports, and then putting these book reports into the trial proceedings to say, look, my client isn't that bad. My client is becoming basically a leftist, and therefore you should let him out because we've changed that mindset. And it's like, that's not the way that it's supposed to work in the American justice system. It's not supposed to matter whether the person is, you know, left or right, politically speaking. That's not the crime. At least it shouldn't be the crime, but increasingly, you know, that is the crime, right? In this guy's case, his crime, his real crime, was being on the right, right? Was watching some Mike Lindell video. That was his actual crime, because that was the reason that he went back to jail. It's not even that he was using an electronic device, as ridiculous as that mandate was. That wasn't it. The issue was what he did with the device. Harati says, hell, just because you're watching something doesn't mean you believe it. Well, that's true. That's true. Though, in the belief of these judges, that's not the case, because whenever they issue these rulings that we talked about last week with the Pride and Prejudice guy, it was, well, not only do you have to read this stuff, but you specifically can't read anything that's considered to be on the right. And, you're specifically prohibited from reading anything that would in any way undermine basically the judge's political opinions in some way. And that's always really fascinating to me, how you could have a judge, or anyone really, who says not only do you have to read what it is that I think you should read, but also you should be prohibited from reading anything that's in argument to that. Right, you should be prohibited from reading the countering view, because the countering view just might win. Because I don't see any other reason why you would want to prevent someone from getting an alternative perspective, unless you're just really afraid that it is those alternative perspectives that are going to have the most weight. Christopher Espoval, they can say that Trump colluded with Russia for 4 years, but nobody could say Biden did anything wrong or they would be persecuted. Well, yeah, and also, kind of on the same token, they also talked about that the Trump election in 2016 was fraudulent, right? I mean, yes, they said it was fraudulent because of Russians, or because of Russian meddling, or because there were too many ads that were placed by Russians, or whatever. And I think they alleged voter fraud from time to time, too. But that was all fine to talk about. But to have any sort of a questioning, to do any questioning, really, regarding the 2020 election was verboten. You're not allowed to do that. Nope. You simply can't. But we won't get too far into that, because, you know. But really, it's difficult not to see that kind of thing at this point. Oh, and by the way, Pfizer is now putting out a drug to fight the virus. They're developing a twice-a-day COVID pill that you take in addition to the vaccine, they said. You take it when you get sick with the virus after you've had the vaccine. I'm not going to say anything about this because, you know, most of you are watching this on YouTube. But I just find it really interesting, okay? So you take the vaccine and every booster. I don't know if there are three or four, but you take everything. And then you get the virus, which Pfizer presumes that enough people will get the virus in any case to necessitate this drug. And then you take their drug. And it's like, well, why wouldn't they? Because the health conversation aside, think of the profit. Because it's like, well, the Biden administration will buy anything and everything now from these pharmaceutical companies, right? Without much oversight, right? Speeding through the previous process for safety, for example. And I'm talking about using emergency authorization, right? Which was done on the basis that we didn't have a treatment, even despite the treatments that you might think exist, that was all. That was the whole thing. That was the basis for emergency authorization for these vaccines. It was, well, we don't have any treatments. Yeah. And but the profit, or the potential for profit from Pfizer's perspective, must be obscene. Well, you know, the Biden administration will buy it and offer it for free to everybody, and it'll be a patented drug, so nobody else can come along and, you know, offer the same thing at a cheaper price. So it's just tax money. And you want to talk about profit motivations when it comes to pharmaceutical companies. Not even talking COVID. You can look at what they do with antibiotics, or the fact that they no longer... No drug company right now is researching an antibiotic. And that's even though they keep telling us that the next bad thing is going to be some super bug that we can't fight due to what they call antibiotic resistance. That is, that a bug will exist that no vaccines will work upon, because the bugs themselves will mutate such that they can't, right, actually work. Okay, so accept that predictively, the companies, oh sorry, I shouldn't say companies, but agencies like the CDC and the FDA have been telling us for some time that sooner or later there'll be this super bug and it'll be antibiotic resistant, and that's the reason we should stop using antibiotics as much as we used to use them, and so on. That's been kind of like the dominant conversation in the healthcare sector for at least 10 years. And well, now they're not developing any antibiotics. You know why? It's not because they don't think that they'll work or something kind of health-related like that. It's because if they develop an antibiotic, well, you take an antibiotic for 2 weeks at most, right? And your bug is dead. Well, there's no profit in that. There's profit in drugs that treat diabetes, and in drugs that treat heart disease, and drugs that treat MS. But by treat, we mean, you know, like, treat the symptoms in different ways. But there's not really as much profit in antibiotics. And so if you really want to know where the where the pharmaceutical companies stand in relation to human life versus profit, I think the kind of antibiotic argument really sums it up for me. The fact they're not even working on them. They're just like, no, there's not that much money there. And besides, if we created a new antibiotic for which, you know, there was no bug that could be resistant because it's new, well, doctors wouldn't use it first anyway. They'd just keep using the other stuff that's already available. So no profit. That's the way the pharmaceutical companies are. And so it doesn't surprise me when they're coming out with, well, we'll come out with the drug that you take after you've taken all, you know, three or four of our booster shots that we also came up with, and we keep coming up with new reasons for new boosters. Yeah, okay. Anyway, that's where we are. Bobble says, Biden says you have to get vaccinated to protect the vaccinated. Yes. Yes, he did actually say that. That in order to protect the vaccinated from the unvaccinated, you had to get vaccinated. It's become the dominant logic it really has become the dominant logic. And so what do you even say? My main problem nowadays with all of this isn't even the lack of logic or even any scientific problem per se. It's not the potential for side effects, which there always is the potential for side effects, as we talked about earlier, with any drug, with any vaccine. It's not any of that. It's the immorality of it. I think it's evil. I think it's absolutely evil to say to somebody, you have to take this shot, else you risk starving, or worse yet, you risk your family starving and being uprooted, and you will have no peace, and you will have no freedom. I think that's evil. And ultimately, that's my main problem at this point. Because, you know, I get it. Naturally speaking, you're not going to have anything that's entirely without risk. That's natural. It's the way it simply is with drugs. The word natural just seems kind of like the wrong word to use. But in any case, it's inherent. How about that? With drugs and with vaccines, that some people will be seriously injured. That's simply the way that it is. And everybody ought to be able to weigh the risks for themselves and for their families. And this used to be something that most people would be like, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Okay, anyway. I'm just kind of going through your comments at this point, because we're way past the hour at this point, so I just thought I'd go ahead and see if there are any, you know, more topics that we should talk about. Someone said we're overdue for the next pandemic. Well, you know, we'll just say that we've got another strain. I mean, although we're not even testing for strains. I don't know if you've noticed, but you know, if you go and get like a test now to see if you've, you know, got the latest strain, they don't test for strains. So I always thought that was particularly interesting. B says forcing anything on one's body is evil. Well, yeah. And it's become so accepted in such a very short time. In such a very short time, people have gone from... I mean, if you'd have said back at 14 days to flatten the curve, if you'd have said back then, well, we're going to mandate that everybody gets this medical treatment, if we're going to call it that, and you don't have an ability to resist, we're going to force the private sector to force it on you. We're going to force, if you're a federal employee, we're just going to tell you, you can get it or you're fired. If you're related in some way, you know, like a private contractor for the government in some way, you're also required to get it. If you'd have said that back then, the very beginning, I mean, can you imagine the outrage, the shock, the horror, the how dare yous? The actual, you know, appropriate ones. Can you imagine? I think that you would have had a very different response. But instead, we've had gradual push and a politicization, that's a word that I just struggled to say, of the whole thing. It was 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and now it's like, 100 million people need to get vaccinated tomorrow. That's a pretty intense change, let's say. Okay, guys, I'm going to go ahead and end this stream, but it has been a blast to hang out with you. It always is. So thank you so much for joining me tonight. It's been fun, and we will, I'm sure, do it again next week. Thank you so much. All right, bye-bye.